This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service. Canada's a nation built through generations of newcomers, but now an asylum backlog coupled with a housing shortage means most Canadians are now questioning immigration levels. Some are calling for a moratorium on immigration, though others say it's needed to ensure Canada's long-term survival. Listen now by searching for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, is Somalia's army strong enough to tackle Al-Shabaab and other security challenges on their own when international forces withdraw? And what would you do if something huge, something loud, something unfamiliar fell from the sky at great speed?
People ran, others went hiding, our cattle ran, and it created a very serious impact of panic. We also have seen serious damages to property.
That's what happened in a remote part of Kenya recently when so-called space junk fell from the sky. It's Thursday, the 9th of January. First, we go to Johannesburg. Water is essential for life. So why is South Africa's biggest city running out of water? Residents in some neighborhoods have long had to queue for water when the municipality failed to deliver piped water. Others, especially those who live in informal settlements, have never had proper water and sanitation. The crisis also affects industry, as many of the region's mines and factories cannot operate without water. The problem grew in seriousness in recent months when hardly a week went by without interruptions to the water supply. The reasons for the situation are varied and we'll get into them shortly. But let's listen to what life is like without a guaranteed supply of running water in one of the most sophisticated cities in Africa. Ferial Adam lives in Johannesburg and I asked her if the water problem came as a surprise to her.
Well, no, it's been many years in the making, obviously, because now we know, after challenging, that not enough has been spent on maintenance of the infrastructure for over 10 years. So obviously, the people in power knew that this was happening and ordinary citizens didn't. So I think that in the last 2 years, ordinary people, and I'm saying like WhatsApp groups and stuff like that, community WhatsApp groups, the conversations have become a little bit more informed because now we know what's going on.
So how do you get water when you need water? Because it's difficult to store water. What do you do?
I have a lot of 5-liter plastic water bottles around my house, upstairs, and I have a little flatlet. When there is water, I fill up all my plastic bottles and keep them around the house so that when there is no water, I can use that for basic things like washing my face or having a quick basin bath, brush my teeth, that kind of thing. And for drinking, I do go and I buy water for drinking, which I can afford to do. But yeah, that's what most people are doing. There've been some days of many days of no showering last year around, you know, when we had the worst periods. And then also I phone family who are maybe not affected, they're in different parts of the city, and then I go and I drive and visit and have a shower. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. But you know, for many people in our WhatsApp groups, they have kids, right? And they've got to get kids to school in the mornings. They've got to get them ready for school in the evenings. And they know that, and it's almost become the norm where you know you've got to make sure that you shower early, you do your cooking early, because you know that at this point, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, you're not going to have water.
There were protests, water protests, electricity protests, protests about generally the standard and cost of living in South Africa. What does the government say to you when there are these protests, when people complain? And when they say that this is not acceptable?
So I think when you say government, let's talk about municipalities, right? Because the water services provider is your responsibility of your local government. And quite honestly, they've been in the city of Johannesburg specifically, there's been very poor leadership and very little has been said in terms of the mayor and the mayoral committees. In fact, at the height of this, there was like just nothing from government. And people will protest, then there'll be a basic kind of statement that just says the same thing. Oh, we have these issues and we have to deal with it. But nothing really that shows leadership or that gives people a sense of we are part of this with you and we're trying to find solutions.
So while the water crisis is on and you're buying your own water, do you have to pay water to the municipality still?
Yes. I mean, I'm renting, right? So yes, I do. I still pay my landlady for water.
That must be really, really galling.
It is. Look, I think that is exactly part of the issue. And there's another issue that you should know about, by the way, is there are these water meters in Johannesburg. And when there's no water, there's air flowing through these meters, which then records you as using water. I don't have that situation, but there are tons of people that have that. And then what happens is air flows faster. And so it records high bills. People have high bills when they haven't had water. And then trying to sort out these bills becomes an added stress and headache for a lot of people in Johannesburg.
So annoying. So
completely
annoying. Oh, my goodness. When I go home and I see the tanks and the, you know, the JoJo tanks, those bigger tanks,
yes.
And then the five,
yes.
5 liters, my mother's garage is full of those.
Yeah.
And no plastic
bottle. I don't throw mine away.
Yeah. No plastic bottle ever gets thrown away. I mean.
Yeah, I don't, because I kind of like feel like I need them all.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it's not realistic because I don't use them all, but I feel like I need them all. I don't know.
Yeah, stale water in plastic bottles. Yeah.
Yes, that's why I don't drink them. I use that for washing dishes or like trying to wash myself. Can you, like, you know, it's crazy.
Feral Adam in Johannesburg. So what are the reasons for this crisis? Karin Bosman is a former senior fellow at the Water Institute of Southern Africa.
I think the causes of the situation is a number of reasons, starting with the fact that South Africa is a dry country, number one, which gets less than the world average of rainfall. And then secondly, we have 11-year cycles of drought, and we are now in the beginning of another 11-year cycle of drought. And that means that the supplies to the dam is not as much as, or the, to the Vaal Dam is not as much as it would normally be. In addition to that, we all have a project with Lesotho where we transfer water from Lesotho to the Vaal Dam system. And this is the large Katse Dam, Lesotho Highlands Water Project, which has to be maintained. And it's big maintenance that's once in every 20 years. Started in October of last year and will last until March of this year, which means while they are maintaining the tunnel network, water from Lesotho cannot come into the Vaal Dam system. So that are the main causes why there's not as much water in the Vaal Dam as it would normally be this time of year, and the dam is currently at 23% full.
You're telling me things that you know as somebody who works in water. Surely government would know this, and surely they would plan for this. Why is the crisis upon us when all these things are known?
The second reason why people are experiencing trouble or concerns, and that comes to the infrastructure from the dam to the municipality and then from the municipality to people's homes. Now, for that is not a national government responsibility. The water in the Vaal Dam, that's national government. But water from the dams through the water supply networks to the people, that's a local municipal responsibility. And that is where we see significant constraints now coming to the fore, where the municipality is not able to properly maintain that infrastructure with pump stations breaking down and people not getting the water supply that they need. Now, we can discuss some of the reasons why the municipal service failure has happened. And I think
we should. I think we should discuss that simply because this is dire. You know, everybody I know in Johannesburg is talking about the effect this is having on them. Hospitals are affected. Hygiene standards everywhere are suffering. People, you know, suffering from waterborne diseases. This is going to go up. So let's talk about why it is. What are the failures at all levels? Now we're talking about the municipality. I know that corruption often comes into this and mismanagement and, no penalties and no sort of policing, as it were, of the authorities that are meant to be doing what they need to do in order to get people safe, clean water. But you're the expert. You tell me.
You know, some of your listeners might be familiar with some of the problems that's being experienced in England with sewage service providers where that had been outsourced to private companies. Now, services should not be rendered for profit. And in some cities in South Africa, the city has maintained the functionality, might outcontract some things like operations, replacements of pipes. But in Johannesburg, they've established a for-profit company to provide the water services. And that's where corruption has become, you know, playing a role, and that there was no proper planning. There is no proper oversight, and also no what we refer to as consequence management, that there is proper consequences for people who are not dealing with
not doing their jobs. Yeah, not doing their jobs.
And the problem doesn't necessarily lie in the technical side of things where, you know, the technician services the pipes and so on. But what we often see is that the problem lies in the procurement and financial divisions of the city, where those officials in procurement have absolutely no idea of what chlorine is that's necessary to disinfect water or what a connector valve is. And then the tenders we've just seen 2 weeks ago, tender for water tankers handed out to people who absolutely have no experience, but that's awarded by the procurement division.
So it's political cronyism divvying up the spoils, right? But, and we should point out that the reason why there are water tankers is because people literally don't have water coming out of their tanks. And these are people who live in big suburbs with beautiful houses and swimming pools and so on. But it's been going on amongst poorer people as well, hasn't it? You know, people in the informal settlements where there's never been proper sanitation anyway and no proper water provision anyway.
That's what we refer to as a socioeconomic drought. And while we might be currently be experiencing a meteorological drought, which simply means we're getting a little less rainfall, a socioeconomic drought is where there's water available but not accessible. And this, what is happening in Johannesburg, the lack of accessibility to water, has been happening in a number of smaller towns throughout the country for some time already, in the Free State, in Natal, in the Eastern Cape. But those people necessarily don't have the voices to make a noise. And now that it's come to the large city houses with the lush gardens who needs water and the swimming pools, now it becomes in the public eye.
Karin Bosman, a former senior fellow at the Water Institute of Southern Africa. The United Nations has authorized a new African peacekeeping mission to continue to support Somalia in its fight against Al-Shabaab, the insurgent group affiliated with Al-Qaeda. It's the latest iteration of the force because, beginning in 2007, Somalia has had international support to help it fight its many security challenges. Let's remind ourselves of the various military interventions in Somalia.
Hi, I'm Nyasha Michelle. Today, we're looking at why peacekeeping forces are in Somalia. It's a story of conflict, international intervention, and the hope for lasting peace. So let's break it down. In 1991, Somalia's government collapsed and the country fell into chaos with no central authority. Rival clans and warlords fought for power, causing widespread violence and famine. A year later, the UN sent peacekeepers to deliver aid and restore order. But the mission ended in 1995 after challenges like the Black Hawk Down incident, which is when US forces attempted to capture two top allies of a Somali warlord in Mogadishu. During this mission, two Black Hawk helicopters were shot down, leaving soldiers trapped and under heavy fire, ultimately leading to the withdrawal of US forces and the mission's end. Almost a decade later, a new threat emerged: Al-Shabaab, a jihadist group aiming to impose strict Islamic law. In 2007, the African Union launched the African Union Mission to Somalia, AMISOM, a peacekeeping force to fight Al-Shabaab and support Somalia's weak government. Amisom helped regain control of major cities, but Al-Shabaab wasn't defeated. In 2022, Amisom transitioned to the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, ATMIS, with a new focus, training Somali forces to take over security by 2024. This year, the African Union Support and Stabilization Mission in Somalia, OSSM, will replace ATMIS. The new mission shifts from combat to support as Somalia takes more control of its security. Now, you may be wondering why the names of the missions change. According to the UN, the aim is to reflect evolving goals, from fighting insurgents to empowering Somali forces to lead. That's the story of Somalia's peacekeeping missions, past and present.
But why does Somalia still need peacekeepers? Well, let's see. Al-Shabaab remains a threat, Somali forces are still developing, and clan disputes continue to fuel instability. So how will this latest mission be different to previous ones? I've been speaking about the most immediate threat to Somalia's stability with BBC Monitoring's Abdullahi Abdi Guji.
The Somali central government collapsed in 1991 and the country descended into civil war for decades. So with the help of the international community, a transitional federal government was established in 2000, and that government was not able to have control of territories of southern Somalia, and because of many clan militias, warlords that were in charge of vast territories of the country, rival warlords. That continued for a while, and then militant group Al-Shabaab came. Before Al-Shabaab, there was an organization called Islamic Courts Union. They took advantage of that situation in Somalia and established essentially courts and other government services in southern Somalia. But then because of fears of radicalization and because of fears of that this was an Islamist government, Ethiopia invaded Somalia in 2006. Pushed out the Islamic Courts Union, captured Mogadishu. But then Al-Shabaab was born now out of the ashes of that Islamic Courts Union, and Ethiopian forces were not able to maintain control of Somalia.
So how significant a threat is Al-Shabaab still now? Because we see them now and then being able to unleash bombs in Mogadishu, operating a shadow government structures, and also still controlling a large part of the country.
They have control of the majority of rural Somalia, which means they have control of key routes that connect major cities. They tax businesses, and it's not a complicated thing. You either provide pay Al-Shabaab's tax or your shop gets blown. It's as easy as that, and people comply out of fear, although they have been pushed out of Mogadishu and other main cities. Their intelligence and other capabilities have not been degraded that much. They remain very powerful. They remain a potent threat. They continue to carry out deadly attacks across southern Somalia. So they have that level of power.
Besides Al-Shabaab being a threat to the safety and security of Somalis, they are not the only source of violence, right? There are also clan clashes in Somalia. Just tell us what that is based on and how the Somali forces are trained or prepared to squash those.
So the clan thing is a very, very powerful thing in Somalia. It's sort of a Somali identity thing. It's more powerful than the national identity. And those clans have a history, a long, long history, even before colonization, of rivalry. Each one vying for power, each one wanting to control resources. That is what, in the first place, caused the collapse of the central government, is because of that clan issue. All the warlords that have come after that have exploited that.
And there are clashes going on right now in different parts of the country.
Sure.
So
sure.
Is the government, other Somali government forces sort of distracted by fighting Al-Shabaab and not concentrating on this? Or do they have a handle on the clan clashes as well?
Right now, there's a distraction. The government is distracted. It is fighting regional states. There have been heavy clashes with troops from the Jubaland Regional Administration are a federal member. So Somalia is a federal state. There are six federal member states, and these member states are very influential, very powerful. And these regional states are set up according to clans. That is still a very, very big problem. Now, Somali forces themselves, they come from these clans. They are trained. They are supposed to be national army soldiers, but sometimes they fight among themselves instead of acting as a cohesive unit. It's a big, huge challenge that's facing the rebuilding of the Somali army. That's why Al-Shabaab could exploit that and take advantage of that.
Let's talk about the other weaknesses and challenges that the Somali army, getting ready to stand on its own feet, face now as African Union forces transition once again to move completely out of the country.
These Somali forces, in theory, they should be able to take over the country from AMISOM. The numbers are there, the equipment are there, they have been trained, but in theory, there are enough numbers to take over southern Somalia and maintain peace. They have not been tested. There was no time where the AU forces were not present to hold back Al-Shabaab, to protect key government offices. That is, of course, the test. And that's the fear that once these AU forces leave, these troops who have been trained with all their challenges, but still trained and equipped with enough numbers, enough weapons to hold the country together, might just collapse the moment these AU forces leave. That is the big, big question. That's the fear. That's why the AU mission is still continuing.
Abdoulaye Abdi Guji, BBC Monitoring. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
A glowing ring of metal, nearly 3 meters wide and weighing more than 500 kilograms, fell from the sky and crash-landed in Mukuku, a village in Kenya, recently. There were no injuries, but it was very, very scary. People in the village thought it was a bomb. Turned out it wasn't a bomb. It was something altogether more mysterious, but no less scary. Turned out to be space debris. Junk that is floating around in space, and there is a lot of it. Given 6 decades of space exploration and thousands of satellite launches in recent years, the Kenya Space Agency identified the object as a separation ring from a launch rocket and said that it was investigating the ring's origin and ownership. But space junk is a growing problem and has the potential to cause great damage to human life and property. Let's hear how the people of Mukuku reacted when a large piece of space debris fell to Earth in their part of the world.
I was sitting at home, then I heard a very loud sound. Do, 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 do. I got out of the house to see what was going on. I saw something huge. It was going in circles, coming down from the sky and coming towards the direction of my house. When it hit the ground, it made a very loud bang. It roared. I was so scared. My house was shaken in the tremor it caused. Out of curiosity, everyone ran to see the massive object. I went back to my house, but it looked different. There were big cracks on the wall. I have not seen this crack here before. I was shocked to see them. I don't feel safe sleeping in my house anymore.
It was loud. People ran. Others went hiding, our cattle ran, and it created a very serious impact of panic. Some even went down on their chairs and others to their beds in fear. Out of ignorance, some of the community members went touching the objects in bare hands. We have had officers from the nuclear department who came to this place yesterday, and we're still waiting to get results from them.
Some of the people of Mukuku there following the landing of an object from space in their village. Temidayo Onyosong is a space scientist and enterprising trailblazer. He's the former regional coordinator for the Space Generation Advisory Council in Africa. And as the head of space in Africa, he is at the forefront of shaping space technology adoption on the continent. He holds a PhD in geography from the University of Delaware in the U.S.
I think over the last couple of decades, we've seen a lot of these events happen. You know, in 2024 alone, there were debris incidents in Florida that damaged the property. There was one occurrence in Canada also, and another one in North Carolina. And the one in Mukuku in Kenya was the last one. So in 2024, we had about four events.
I believe that there's a case being investigated in Uganda. People say that there was space debris, which is still under investigation. What can you tell us about that?
You know, in the last couple of years, aside from the recent events in Kenya, we've had objects falling in Cote d'Ivoire. And in 2023, we had an object in Uganda. Debris fell over Western Uganda. And reports by some, you know, forensic experts actually identified this object as being potentially linked with SpaceX. And this shows that while the objects in Kenya, for example, didn't impact any object, the one in Uganda actually impacted a house. And there are regulations and international treaties that actually guide some of these things.
Right. Let's talk about who is responsible for the debris. Is it possible to say where it comes from, who's responsible for it? And if it does damage property and if it does cause somebody's life, who should be held responsible for it?
So according to the Outer Space Treaty from like the 1967, there are regulations around this. So typically, if an object falls down like that, the party responsible is the party that actually launched it. So when you do some forensic analysis on some of these objects, you can detect from whom they belong to. And when you do that, when you ascertain that, then you can reach out to those institutions by returning those objects and also asking for compensation for whatever damages might have happened.
Have there been cases of damages being awarded to whoever was affected by it?
I don't have that information. These things actually happen at diplomatic level also. So even if the object is launched by a private company, it's the government that would be held responsible. So whatever object that is detected, if the object was launched by a private company, the government under which the object is registered would be held responsible for this. So, for example, SpaceX as a private American company, the U.S. government would be held responsible for this. And the recovery and return of space debris is actually a central part of the 1968 rescue agreement of the U.N. Office of Outer Space Affairs. So this treaty requires that state parties return any foreign space objects discovered in their territory to their owner. So in this case, first of all, the Kenyan government needs to figure out who this object belongs to. And when they do that, the next step is supposed to be to facilitate the return of these objects to the government from which this object was registered to. If the object caused any damages, the next step is to also notify the government as well as the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs of the damages and, you know, what sort of compensation they're actually requesting for. A launching state should be responsible and absolutely liable to pay compensation for damages caused by its space objects on the surface of the Earth.
How does one know that whatever has fallen on your house or scared your cows or terrified the life out of you is space debris?
You can call the police, but for countries with national space program, the first line of action for the police would be to actually notify the National Space Agency. So for a random person walking on the street and an object falling from the sky, I think the first line of action is to notify the government. So that can be the security agencies.
So is there a monitoring system in place now to ensure that the debris that does fall is traced, and so you can sort of anticipate where it would fall and that you could perhaps warn the people in the vicinity of, you know, the trajectory of that falling object?
Absolutely. So one of the critical strategy of, you know, responsible space practice is being able to track all of these objects, because when you can track them, when you know all the tiny objects in space, you can actually prepare for impact, or even you can safeguard even your objects in space also. And we've got a lot of national governments and national space agencies that have systems in place for this, like NASA, where they can actually track objects. Currently, tens of thousands of objects are being tracked. And beyond tracking, we also have a lot of international organizations and, you know, national organizations that are also engaged in activities to promote responsible space usage. They're thinking of a zero debris approach that ensures safe disposal of space objects and missions that actually emphasize self-disposal.
So what's happening between Kenya now and apparently an Indian company, which has been, in terms of Kenya's investigations, been found to be responsible for the object that fell in the village in southern Makueni County in Kenya on the 30th of December. The Kenya Space Agency has denied reports that it's demanding compensation from India after this object fell in the village. It says the investigations are still ongoing. So what would be happening now?
Yeah, Kenya is still investigating on where this object is from. And I think when the investigation is done and they've concluded on, oh, this is where the object originates from, I believe that their next line of action would be to actually facilitate the return of this object to the government of the country from which this object originates from. This is also a diplomatic issue. I think the Kenyan government will look at their diplomatic relationship with whichever government this object originates from. And in a bid to safeguard that diplomatic relationship, I expect that they would act according to the guidelines of the Outer Space Treaty.
Temidayo Onyosun, head of space in Africa and former regional coordinator for the Space Generation Advisory Council in Africa. Focus on Africa was produced by Sunita Nahar, Yvette Twagira Maria, Nyasha Michelle, and Bella Hassan. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer on the team. Gabriel O'Regan was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America. And the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.